From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
More moves against Venezuela at the Organization of American States, which is dominated by the U.S., and an electoral victory in Ecuador that leaves Julian Assange safe and the country in the hands of its leftist government. For more on that, we speak with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
That leads us into talking about this tremendous win by Lenin Moreno in Ecuador. They won by not a very big margin, it was just over 2%. That's very similar to the result in Argentina and the result also in Brazil when Dilma was elected. And I think she barely won by 3% back in 2015 when she defeated the right-wing candidate Aécio Neves. And in Argentina, Mauricio Macri only beat Danilo Scioli, the candidate of Cristina Fernandez, the Kirchner's Front for Victory party, and I think that was also a very narrow margin of 2%. Now, it's fantastic that Moreno won, but it just shows the still very, very entrenched power of the right-wing elites in the country, especially in a depressed economic context in the region.
Right.
Because they can argue, well, look, what have those progressive policies done for you? And look at the economic situation. We can do better, which is a complete lie, of course, as demonstrated by the lamentable performance of Mauricio Macri and his team in Argentina.
Yeah, but in all of those places, you have the media in the hands of the right wing. I mean, it's the private media, which is wall to wall part of the media, are all aligned with the right wing.
Yeah, and in Ecuador, that one of the reasons that Moreno won, I'm absolutely convinced that one of the reasons that Moreno won is that Rafael Correa's administration managed to pass a piece of legislation reining back the worst excesses of the right-wing media in Ecuador.
Yeah, and there was a big cry here when that happened, too. Oh, my God, censorship, that the government would dare to make a law about media.
Yeah, and you can see that process is what enabled Macri, the process of the way the right-wing corporate media in these countries actually take over the role of the political opposition, and that was very much what happened in Argentina during Macri's campaign back in September, October 2015. He won the election in November.
Yeah.
And you can see it also at work in the situation in Venezuela. But the key takeaway from this is that Moreno won. He won by a very narrow margin. And that indicates how stupid and unhelpful and completely lacking in explanatory power are all these caricature explanations that you read in so much of the corporate Western media. And they'll talk about a pink tide of progressive governments, or they'll talk about a conservative restoration.
Right.
These ways of describing the process that's in play in Latin America are a complete distraction. They completely distract from the processes that are really at work. And the process that's really at work is, are the recipes, the economic recipes, the political and social recipes that are supposed to foment prosperity, peace, justice, equity, equality in general, and do those policies work from one side or the other? And if you look at the record of progressive governments throughout the region, whether it's Venezuela or in Argentina, Brazil, or any of these countries, the record of progressive political movements is far superior to the record of their right-wing counterparts. even in a depressed economic context, because at the moment you have to remember that Ecuador is also, like Venezuela, a member of OPEC and has been very seriously affected by the collapse in the oil prices over the last year and a half. And so in that context, and also in the context of a general global slowdown in trade, and even in that very favorable context, Guillermo Lasso, who was the right-wing candidate, failed to win. Now, there may be, you could argue, oh, well, that's not really reflective of the overall realities, because Guillermo Lasso was in fact quite a weak candidate. He was a weak candidate because of his dreadful record of corruption, which came to the fore in the campaign in the last couple of weeks of the campaign.
That doesn't exactly distinguish him, though, among the other champions of the conservative restoration, or whatever they call it.
Yeah, the thing is that it was very interesting that, for example, Mauricio Macri is also another extremely corrupt politician with a dreadful record in that regard. But the news about his role, for example, in the Panama Papers scandal didn't come out until after the election.
That's
whereas
right.
What happened to, in the case of Lasso was that the news about his link selling himself his own bank, for example, and the accounts and making a lot of money on that transaction, and his various links to companies in tax havens, and a whole series of revelations. They came out in the last 2 weeks before the election, and I think that definitely assisted Lenin Moreno, and also, and the events in Argentina and in Brazil, where the right-wing governments have imposed their agenda in an extremely counterproductive way that's led to a marked decline in living standards for millions of people in Brazil and Argentina.
Yeah, well, you pointed that out, that, you know, when Macri ran, for example, he ran a very nebulous campaign with very general promises that things would be better, but no particulars. And then once he got in, he immediately started to implement very particular policies and a very particular program, which caused the things that you're talking about. People in Ecuador got to see that, got to see what Temer did when they removed Dilma Rousseff, and maybe it gave a lot of them pause.
Yeah, and that dynamic of people at grassroots observing what's going on in the rest of the region is also at play in Venezuela. But before we move on to Venezuela, perhaps, it would be a mistake to think that Lenin Moreno, backed by Rafael Correa, together with his vice presidential candidate Jorge Glass, didn't run a very good campaign, and their campaign was based on very positive factors in their favor. And under Rafael Correa, for whom Lenin Moreno for a time was vice president, and I think until 2013 he was vice president to Rafael Correa, so he's very much associated with the advances and the progress that have been made in Ecuador over the last 10-15 years. Sorry, and it'll be 10 years actually, because Rafael Correa actually came into office back in 2006, I think. Anyway, they as a team and as the leaders of the Alianza País political movement, they engaged in what they called a revolución ciudadana, a citizen revolution, in which they made a huge transfer of resources to ordinary people via better education, better health care, more investment in social services, and better pensions, an approach that an economic approach somewhat similar to the model here in Nicaragua, but Nicaragua is a special case in many ways, but they fomented this business confidence and made it possible for Ecuador to transform itself as a society. And because you've got to remember that prior to 2006, and something like 2 million people from Ecuador emigrated. You know, I've forgotten what the population of Ecuador is. I think it's something like 18 to 20 million, something like that. But in that period of time between 1998 and in which Guillermo Lasso was a key figure involved in the economic decisions that kind of very, very much damaged Ecuador's economic and social well-being. Between something like 1998 and 2006, something like 2 million Ecuadorians emigrated. And so that's what Rafael Correa and his team did from between 2006 and 2016 was transform Ecuador's society and economy in a way that gave people confidence in their country and made them feel that they had a future, and you can see in Argentina and Brazil that what the right wing do is they kind of deny people a future with a decent life. So the right wing offer these ridiculous pseudo technocratic policies, these neoliberal economic and social policies that in theory are supposed to make an economy more efficient and a society more prosperous, and they never deliver. And you can that is the fundamental argument in Latin America, in the Caribbean, in Central America and South America. What is the kind of model that's going to generate more social justice, more equality, more economic prosperity, more economic democracy, more importantly? And that model is not the right-wing model. And I think that it's going to be very, very difficult over the next 3 to 4 years as the Latin American economy recovers from the current recession. It's going to become increasingly difficult for right-wing political movements to win electoral victories. And that's why you're seeing, for example, the accusations taken to resulting in a court case against Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and that's why you're seeing, as you said, these attacks via the courts against Ignacio Lula da Silva, who's likely to be the next presidential candidate for the Workers' Party in Brazil and will win an election hands down if it were held today. And also that's why you're seeing the ability of the Venezuelan authorities to defeat the attempted coup that has many facets and many aspects. And perhaps we could talk a bit about how the Organization of American States has probably written its some death warrant over the last week or so.
Yeah, and I also want to get to Mercosur, because to me that was the most outrageous thing when they start trying machinations there. If I'm not mistaken, a large part of the budget for Mercosur came out of Venezuela.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons that Venezuela was able to gain entry into Mercosur. And perhaps we should explain to people who might not know that Mercosur is essentially a trade bloc that was founded back in the early 1990s, made up Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay. Obviously, completely dominated by Brazil, because Brazil's, what is it, the ninth or tenth largest economy in the world?
Yes, it's large, yeah.
So then Mercosur stagnated all through the early 2000s, and Hugo Chavez took the initiative to try and revive Mercosur and make it an engine of regional integration and regional growth and regional prosperity. But his initiative to integrate Venezuela into Mercosur met fierce resistance from the right wing in the Mercosur countries, which was largely overcome, as you say, by the huge economic advantage of Venezuela's oil wealth.
Yeah.
And it was projected to transform Mercosur from a somewhat neoliberal, hidebound, stagnant, dormant, moribund organization into an organization that would become part of a dynamic process of regional integration, not just economic but also political integration. And what's happened is that because the Brazil and Argentina have been taken over by right-wing governments and are able to put huge pressure on their two smaller partners, Paraguay and Uruguay. And Uruguay, in theory, should be a progressive government. But now what you had in Mercosur was Uruguay participating. And Uruguay has received huge benefits from Venezuela. And I should imagine the Venezuelan authorities are very bitter about what Uruguay, the role of Uruguay in the internal mechanism that they activated in Mercosur, condemning condemning Venezuela, and alleging that there's an institutional rupture in Venezuela that puts the country's democracy at risk, which is absolutely outrageous.
It's ridiculous. But before we get into that, some context, I just want people to understand, at the time frame that Venezuela, came in, you had leftist governments in Lula in Brazil. You had Nestor and Cristina Kirchner in Argentina. You had the world's poorest president, leftist, in Uruguay. And you had a leftist government in Paraguay. That was the first to go via soft coup. You now have right-wing governments in Brazil and Argentina and Paraguay, and the left-wing government teaming up with the right on Venezuela now.
Yes, Uruguay went through a period in the mid-2000s when it had very serious financial problems, and Venezuela essentially bankrolled them.
That's right. Yep.
For them to turn around and essentially stab Venezuela in the back like that by participating actively, apparently, in this internal Mercosur process, declaring that there's a crisis of democracy in Venezuela. And why is that important? That's important because that plays into and reinforces and consolidates efforts by the Organization of American States General, Secretary General Luis Almagro, who is
from Uruguay.
He's a former Uruguayan foreign minister.
Right.
And he's been going to extraordinary lengths and really making very clear his role as a kind of lapdog of the United States government and of the Canadian government too, because what triggered the crisis over the weekend? Maybe we should start there.
First, describe the crisis, because people don't know it here.
Yeah, and in Venezuela, and for months, ever since the legislative elections, and when was it? The end of 2016? No, at the end of 2015.
Yeah.
And the right wing won a very big majority, almost enough to change the constitution and take measures to roll back the Bolivarian Revolution. But among the legislators that were elected, there were three very questionable candidates who were apparently elected with very serious anomalies in violation of Venezuela's electoral law.
Fraud. And a finding in the courts of that.
Yeah. So the electoral authority in Venezuela ruled that those deputies couldn't take their seats in the legislature until there was a satisfactory resolution of the status of the vote in those three cases. And despite that ruling, the legislature in Venezuela integrated those three legislators into the National Assembly in complete violation of the country's electoral law, and subsequently the Supreme Court had to rule about what the status was of those legislators, and it ruled that until the electoral authority ratified their election, they they could not participate in the legislature, and if the legislature insisted, then the National Assembly, Venezuela's legislature, was not in compliance with the law, and its decisions were not valid.
Right.
None of its decisions. Right. So then what happened? So what the, instead of, and the Venezuelan opposition is really stupid, because, and if they, if they'd taken an intelligent approach to that, if they hadn't been in such a hurry to overthrow Maduro, if they could just have taken their time, and they could have behaved as a normal legislature, accepted the institutional framework, accepted the democratic decisions of the Electoral Tribunal and the Supreme Court, and won the confidence, they could have proceeded over time to win the confidence of the Venezuelan people by engaging in a legislative program with social responsibility and so forth, all the, you know, all those good things that legislatures are supposed to do. And instead of doing that, they engaged in essentially behavior to force a coup d'etat, to force the overthrow of the president. And about a month ago, they actually engaged in a process where they declared that Nicolas Maduro was in fact absent from his office.
Right.
You know, a completely absurd process. But no, nothing appeared in the international corporate press about that.
Not at all.
As a coup against, you know, an internal coup. Nothing appeared in the international corporate media about that. And then what happened over the last couple of weeks is that very important legislation that needed to be voted on to enable Venezuela to, for, essentially to enable Venezuela's oil company, PDVSA, which is the kind of the essential motor still of the Venezuelan economy, although that situation is changing. PDVSA needed to engage in some contracts, to engage in some processes to access credit, to enable it to carry out its essential role in Venezuela's economy. And that was being blocked because the National Assembly was not functioning, because it was refusing to accept the rulings of the rival powers. There are five constitutional powers in Venezuela, two, one of which is the electoral authority, one is the Supreme Court, one is the legislature, one is the executive, the presidency, and the fifth is what's called the citizens' power. So because the legislature refused to accept the legitimate root judgments of two of the other powers of state, it was refusing to vote on this very important administrative legislative measure for the future of PDVSA. So at that point, the Supreme Court activated the constitution in Venezuela, under which it is entitled to act in the name of the legislature if the legislature is inoperative. And they did so. But when they did so, they did so in such a way, and still based on the Venezuelan constitution, but they did so in such a controversial way that it was interpreted by the right wing. The right wing were able to take advantage of the Supreme Court's ruling to claim that they dissolved the National Assembly. In fact, they hadn't, of course, dissolved the National Assembly. All they did was say that as long as the National Assembly was not operative, because it was refusing to obey the judgments of the Supreme Electoral of the Electoral Tribunal, that the deputies in the National Assembly would not have their immunity. That was the main issue, along with the other part of the judgment, which stated that the constitutional chamber of the Supreme Court would have to take on the functions of the National Assembly.
Right.
So that, and that created a storm of controversy immediately after the previous week's session in the Organization of American States about Venezuela, which Luisa Almagro had been pushing for. And so this new crisis, this new chapter in the crisis, which is essentially a crisis of a constitutional crisis of provoked by the failure of the right-wing opposition-dominated National Assembly to recognize the legitimacy of the other powers in Venezuela. This latest chapter enabled Luis Almagro to deepen his attempts and broaden his attempts to attack Venezuela from the Organization of American States in a way that, a very high-profile way, and that he hoped, again, without success, would create a context forcing other countries in the region to take decisive steps and perhaps even to the point of imposing sanctions on Venezuela. Now, in the OAS, and I think in our last conversation, I suggested that Luis Almagro had very little chance of pushing through the measure which would activate the so-called Democratic Charter in the OAS, which is the mechanism by means of which the United States and its allies in the region could isolate and impose sanctions on Venezuela. And I thought he had very little chance of doing that. And I was proved right again, both last week and in this last session, which was on Monday this week, just a couple of days ago. And in that session, a total of 17 countries proposed a vote, and it was 13 countries proposed a vote on whether or not to move forward with potential measures from the OAS and its member states against Venezuela. And they failed again. I think they got 17 votes out of a total of 23 that were present. But one of the aspects of that vote on Monday that was completely anti-democratic, and it's so ironic that the OAS, Organization of American States, is behaving in exactly the way that they falsely accused Venezuela of doing, because they violated their own institutional procedures and norms by refusing to notify the president of the permanent council. And this is all very boring procedural stuff, but it's important from the point of view of the integrity of the non-existent integrity of the Organization of American States Secretariat, and in particular its Secretary General Luis Almagro, because they were duty-bound to advise the president of the permanent council, which is now Bolivia, pro-tempore president, of the procedure, and to coordinate and in a collaborative way, cooperative way, with Bolivia in order to make that session happen. And they didn't.
Right.
The vice president for the pro-tempore was Haiti, and Haiti also did not take part in this kangaroo procedure, this false procedure on Monday, and they ended up on a spurious technical procedure having Honduras of all countries, a country that's with the governments that's essentially the result of a coup,
right,
in 2009 that was facilitated by the Organization of American States at the time because they refused to condemn it as a military coup. But anyway, I think that's another story. Honduras then took over the presidency of the OAS Permanent Council and facilitated this completely illegal meeting where countries, again, for the second time in a couple of weeks, discussed the internal affairs of another country without that country being present.
Here's the last irony, really. I mean, that's the deepest one. You have an illegal government chairing a meeting in violation of the rules of the OAS seeking under a democratic charter to meddle in the democratic affairs of Venezuela, contrary to its constitution. And we got to leave it there, Tony. But thanks a lot, and we'll catch up with you again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.